welcome to another Glenn and Helen podcast. It's an all science fiction episode today with interviews with John Scalzi, a blogosphere favorite, and another blogosphere favorite, Tim Minear.
John Scalzi is the author of Old Man's War and Ghost Brigades. Tim Minear is the screenwriter and executive producer who's worked on Angel, Firefly, Wonderfalls, The Inside, and more. We'll be asking both of them about their work, their fans, and the internet. John Scalzi is the author of Old Man's War, a science fiction book that has been extremely popular in the blogosphere, and it's racked up huge sales based on internet word of mouth. Now he's got a new book out called Ghost Brigades, and he's hoping to repeat the process. He's here to talk to us today about science fiction, the internet, and the joys of working at home.
John, tell us a little bit about the setting for Old Man's War and Ghost Brigades.
Well, the basic setting is that mankind has gone out into the universe, and the entire universe is a very bad neighborhood. Although there are hundreds of alien species, and it appears, at the very least, that all these species are extremely hostile. They are not willing to share their planets. They're not willing to cede any planets to the humans. And so basically, it's a situation where there's conflict from the word go. Humans put out their colonies. The colonies are always in danger of being attacked. And so the humans have become very aggressive. They have a standing army called the Civil Defense Forces, or the Colonial Defense Forces, which basically goes from hotspot to hotspot dealing with aliens and fighting the wars and doing all that sort of stuff. Now, it's an interesting thing because immediately speaking, from a writer's point of view, it's very easy because there's always some sort of conflict. But there's also the questions of what sort of society does this engender? What sort of things do people do when they are constantly under siege? And so a lot of that stuff is in the background of these books, but it's always something that's always simmering there. It's an interesting universe to work with, although it's not particularly a universe I would want to live in.
Well, the soldiers are actually rejuvenated old people, right? They kind of get an interesting deal offered to them for enlistment.
That's right. In Old Man's War, what happens is that the Colonial Defense Forces recruits from Earth, and it recruits old folks. And the deal is, once you turn 75, you can sign up, and they'll give you a rejuvenated body that is actually better than new. It's been genetically engineered to be super strong, super fast, and it's got a computer in the brain, which is called a brain pal, which allows you to communicate very quickly with other folks and to basically do a lot of threat assessment and basically just be a lot quicker, better soldier. Now, the flip side of it is, again, it's an extremely hostile universe, so there's not a guarantee that you're going to live very long in your shiny new body. And this is one of the questions. Given a choice, would you have a brand new body but have the possibility? In the book, it says something along the lines of, out of every 10 people who fight, over the course of 10 years, 8 of them are going to die. So would you take that risk to have a brand new body and to also have a new life, because at the end of your term of service, you get to become a colonist? Or is it better to stay old and safe and die in your bed?
So, John, would you take that deal? I'm not sure I would.
Well, you see, that's a really good question. I mean, right now, I'm 36, and I'm in reasonably good health, so I wouldn't be inclined necessarily to take that deal. You would need to ask me again in 39 years when I'm 75 years old, and I may or may not be, physically ready to trade up. And I think that that's what a lot of the issue is with the humans in the book. Also, the other thing is that in Old Man's War, the folks who are on Earth are basically quarantined on Earth. So the only way that you're going to get out and see the rest of the universe is if you sign up. And I think that that holds a great attraction as well. And that might be the one thing that switches me over from saying no to saying yes, because I wouldn't want to die and not see the rest of the universe.
So is Ghost Brigades a sequel to Old Man's War, or is it just sort of, would you characterize it more as a story that's set in another part, well, in the same universe, but without really being sort of a part of the same story arc?
It's a quasi-sequel in the sense that there are a number of the same characters who are in the first book reappear in the second book, but it is what it's not is it's not a direct sequel. I mean, this is something that I feel actually very strongly about, which is I hate going into a bookstore and pulling down a book, and the book looks really interesting, and then I see it's book two of the, you know, whatever cycle.
Right.
And there's no book one, because they, you know, the bookstore, you can't rely on them basically to stock all the books in the sequence. And so you put it back because you don't want to basically jump in the middle of a story. I'm not successful enough yet that I can give people an excuse to put my book back. So what I did was I wrote a story that takes place in the same universe, has some of the same characters, but the primary story is something that stands alone. So if you've read Old Man's War, it's going to be something that you'll have a richer experience, because some of the references and stuff like that will mean more to you. But if you haven't read it, you can still go forward, and then you can go and check out Old Man's War afterwards. We'll have a third book in the series, which will be called The Last Colony, which I'm going to try to do the same thing. Now, they'll all be loosely connected. For example, characters in the first book and the second book will be primary characters in the third book as well. So there's definitely a story arc that goes between them all. But again, don't give your readers an excuse not to pick up your book. That's a good motto to live by.
So has the internet helped you to sell these books? Do you think internet word of mouth helps?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I'll give you an example just today. The book Ghost Brigades came out yesterday. Boing Boing, which is Cory Doctorow's site and several other people, the group site, he mentioned it today. My Amazon ranking today is, last time I checked, it was 164. So,
well, that's great. And yeah. I know we sell a lot of Old Man's War.
Well,
yeah,
I've linked
exactly.
It several times, yeah. And it seems to get a lot of attention.
Right. Well, no, I mean, and you guys are the perfect example of that. I remember back before Old Man's War was, I had just sold it, and I went to the Tor, and they were like, well, who should we give copies of this to? And I said, I want you to give copies to Glenn Reynolds of Vince Pundit. And they're like, who is he? Why would we do this? And I'm like, trust me, you want to do this. And so, as you know, they sent you an ARC, you mentioned it, and the book sales on the Amazon ranking went from, it was like 150,000 that day, up to 900. And I immediately sent them, you know, the stats as they were updated. I'm like, see, this is why you want to do it. Because what you have and what Corey has and what a lot of the people online have is more than just a recommendation like a newspaper where it's sort of impersonal. Your readers feel like they are part of your community. They're your friends. They're in a relationship with you that's different than a reviewer in a magazine or a newspaper. So when you say, I like this, or when Corey says, I like this, it means significantly more than if the guy in the newspaper says, I like this. Now, don't get me wrong. I like it when the newspapers say, I like the book. But if I had to choose between somebody in the newspaper or you or Corey, I know where I would go for the recommendation.
Well, I read these books for fun primarily, and I guess professional reviewers read them for money primarily, and that does give you sort of a different take on the whole thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is interesting. I mean, I should note that one of the things that I've done over the course of my life has been a professional reviewer. I've reviewed movies, and I review DVDs currently, and one of the things that you do there is you just have so much volume. So even when you like something, it's part of a whole process. It doesn't mean that the paid reviewer can't be a fair broker of value, like this is a good book, this is a bad book, but it is a mechanistic process. They do have, when I was reviewing movies, I had 5 movies a week to review, and so it was basically in the gullet, out the gullet. Basically, when you say something like, this is the book I'm reading, and I like this, they realize that it's not part of a machine, that you're not paid to do it, you're not required to make the recommendation. And I think that also adds some value in terms of whether or not they think this is a more faithful, accurate representation of something that you actually like.
Along the same lines, do you think that first-time novelists could sell a book over the Internet? Isn't that kind of what you did with one of yours?
So, I've sold 2 of my novels online. Old Man's War, I wrote it, and then I thought about the prospect of trying to sell it. And selling books is just a pain, especially if you're writing genre fiction. I mean, you submit it, it goes in the slush pile, you wait a year to be rejected, and then you got to send it out again, and you wait another year to be rejected, and I just didn't want to deal with it. And at the time, this was 2002, I'd already had a site that had some, you know, had a fair number of visitors, so I was like, you know what, to heck with it, I'm going to serialize it. And so I put up a chapter a day during December of 2002, and at the very end of it, when I was done, I got an email from Patrick Nielsen Hayden, who was at Tor, and he said, I like your book, you know, I'd like to buy it. To which I said, well, okay, if you must. And then once Old Man's War came out, Subterranean Book Publisher, or Subterranean Press Publisher, Bill Schaefer, did the same thing for a book that I had online for a while called Agents of the Stars. Now, there's two things about that. I mean, one, it is still extremely unusual for this to happen. I mean, the thing that I tell people is, in the history of the Internet, there have been maybe four or five science fiction fantasy books that have been sold this way, while at the same time, there have been literally thousands of books that have been sold the old-fashioned way. So your odds of selling it this way are not particularly good. Now, what the Internet can do is help you develop a reputation, help you develop a following. I mean, I know for certain that in addition to liking the book, one of the considerations for Tor was that I basically had a pre-installed base of several thousand readers daily. And so those are several thousand readers that they would not have to work to reach. They wouldn't have to work to reach. So from a strictly marketing point of view, coming with your own fandom, so to speak, is an immensely powerful thing. It's immensely useful, and I think that going forward, a lot of writers are going to have that coming in. They'll be looking not only at how good the book is, but, okay, the book is good, and he's got a popular website, or and he has this web presence. This helps us. This will help us when it comes time to publish the book.
Well, I noticed there sure are a lot of blogging science fiction writers now. You've got John Birmingham and Ken McLeod and Tobias Bacall. I mean, the list just goes on and on.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess people are caught on to that. Or maybe it's just that, you know, people who are already writers like to write.
Well, I think it's two things. I mean, I do think that other science fiction writers saw some of the early leaders in that, which include someone like Patrick Nielsen Hayden, who's at Tor, and some of the other writers, and saw that these people not only were, you know, basically having an outlet where they could, where fans could see them on a daily basis, even if they didn't have a book in front of them, but they also saw that they were building communities, and that's really important because on a day-to-day basis, you know, a book comes out maybe once a year, and during the interim, your readers are doing other things with their lives, but if you can find a way to bring them back and make them, you know, make them have you as a daily visit, they're going to be a lot more engaged and they're going to be a lot more aware of what you're doing, and that's going to be useful. So I think they saw a lot of that. I think it's also just a community thing. I mean, genre authors, like science fiction authors or crime authors or horror authors, they basically know each other. They're fairly small worlds. And so this is just basically a way to keep track of what everybody else is doing in your same line of work.
Well, it's sort of an extension of going to science fiction conventions or something in a way. You can interact with the fans and with each other and kind of keep the community going.
Oh, yeah. I think that's exactly right. I mean, I was at BosCon, which was a science fiction convention this weekend, and I saw Cory Doctorow and I saw Charlie Strauss and I saw Toby Buckle and saw a number of other folks. And then we come back and then we write about who we've seen then we also talk about some of the things that we've talked about. And so what happens at the con leaks into what's going on online, and so our readers feel like, you know, they were partly there as well. And again, it's just the whole cycle of keeping people engaged in what you're doing and what the community is doing.
You mentioned on your blog that wireless internet changed the way you work at home. How did it change?
Well, it made it possible, basically. I mean, I live in a rural area of Ohio where the nearest McDonald's is literally 11 miles away. The nearest Walmart, the nearest Staples is 11 miles away. If I want to get anything done, I have to be connected. And the only way to be connected is basically through the Internet. I mean, one of the things that I was absolutely concerned about when we moved here in 2001 was that I would move here. We moved from suburban D.C., and I was worried that I would get out here and I would have no work because no one would be able to reach me. But basically, the first thing we did was we installed satellite internet, which was at the time the fastest thing we could get. And after 2 weeks, everybody called me back. They're like, "You're settled, right? Let's get working." And it was literally, there was no difference between working in, you know, rural Ohio and working in suburban Washington, D.C. People could reach me. They could send me the emails. We could do everything that we were doing before. There was no temporal barrier or no spatial barrier to anything we were doing. And so, you know, frankly, I have book publishers that are in London. I have book publishers that are in San Diego. I have book publishers that are in New York. And I can relate to them just as easily and equally, no matter where they are. It's extremely important. I couldn't be doing what I'm doing if I was doing it 15 years ago or even 10 years ago.
You know, we interview so many people who say things like that. You also mentioned that having the wireless internet in your house meant you could work without pissing off your wife and daughter so much.
Well, yes, it's absolutely true. If I'm able to take my laptop computer and sit at the kitchen island and type something instead of staying stuck in my office, then it matters because, you know, most of what I do is on a computer, and so I'm facing forward away from the rest of the house looking into a computer all the time. And in some ways it's very alienating for the rest of my family because, you know, they every time they see me, they see my back. But so if I go and I take my laptop and I put it in the room where, you know, my daughter's playing, or if I put it in the room where my wife is talking to me, we can actually communicate and I can still do a certain amount of work without being completely cut off. Now, there are times when I'm like, okay, I absolutely have to close the door and get things done. But on a day-to-day basis, it makes a difference between, you know, whether they're like, oh, leave daddy alone, he's, you know, he's busy, or they feel like I'm actually part of their family life while still being able to get some of the stuff that I need to get done. So yes, I think it's absolutely critical, and I think it changes the way, certainly I interact with my own work, and it certainly changes the way that I interact with my family. I mean, division of the two is hard enough when you work from home like I do,
mm-hmm.
And so this is, just makes it a much easier transition for everybody.
So instead of going to a marriage counselor, a person should just get the internet at home to save their marriage? Is that the idea?
Well, I think it does matter. I mean, my wife has a love-hate relationship with my computer, and I think a lot of writers' spouses would say the same thing. It's like that it is the, you know, the other person, the third person in the relationship. And so you have the question of, is this third person, is it going to be an impediment, or is it going to be someone who you can work, you know, through? So this, I think that's just a fundamental question for everybody.
My wife and daughter have dealt with that by getting on the computer all the time themselves.
Can't beat them, join them.
My daughter's on the way there. My wife, not so much.
Helen had one more question about your books here, kind of the gender question.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about, seem to have a lot of tough female characters in both books, and I noticed that some of your commenters on your blog suggested that they're unrealistic.
Mm-hmm.
You see a lot of tough women in science fiction, though. What's that about, and are they realistic or not?
Well, anyone who says that tough women are not realistic has not met my wife.
Or mine.
I mean, yeah, no, I think Glenn and I are in the same boat.
We're not women, I know.
My wife is 5'10". She's stronger than I am. She's meaner than I am. If you get in her way, she will literally eat your heart, you know. And this is one of the things that I find it very difficult that people can't believe that this is true. I mean, my ex-girlfriend, who I am very close to, she's a second-degree black belt. I mean, I've not dated women who are not tough, smart, independent women. So whenever people say, well, that's not realistic, I'm like, maybe you need to get out more and meet more today's women, because this is absolutely realistic from my own personal experience with women. And, you know, the other thing is, I have a daughter. You know, I want to be able to say to my daughter, who is 7 years old, you know, that you can do anything you want, that, you know, you should not have any impediments, you know, that anytime anyone tells you that you can't do something, that you do it, and then you laugh in their face. So, it's a question that I don't really understand on an emotional level.
Yeah, I don't either. I just saw the commenters on your blog suggesting that, so I was just asking about it.
Yeah, no.
So you're going to let your daughter read Old Man's War when she's how old?
As soon as she can read it, if she thinks she can read it, we'll see. there's some, you know, there's some language there that's probably not appropriate for her, but, you know, my feeling about it is let her pick things up and then come to us with questions. And we've done some of that so far. She's picked up some or had some questions for us that I wasn't expecting until at least 12 or 13. But
yeah, we know about that, too. Well, listen, thanks so much for joining us, and I hope people will go out and read Old Man's War and Ghost Brigades, because I've read them both, and I liked them a lot.
Thank you very much. Thank you both.
Thank you. Tim Minear is a screenwriter and the executive producer of a lot of shows with intense followings, Angel, Firefly, and Wonderfall, and of course the movie Serenity. He's got an intense internet following himself. You don't see many executive producers with fan websites. We've got him on the phone talking about life, the internet, and what he's working on now. First of all, the question people keep asking is there any chance of a second season of Firefly?
Well, I mean, there's always a chance, I suppose. I know of nothing that is in the works at the moment. My answer is chance, sure. Is there a Santa Claus?
Well, you seem to have a lot of shows that get picked up for about 13 episodes and then drop. Do you think there's a reason for that?
I guess I suck.
You suck?
I mean,
no?
There's the suckage. I'll try not to stammer. You know, I mean, that's sort of the odds. Do you know what I mean? It's like
sure.
A networks order a certain amount of pilot scripts every year, like many, many pilot scripts. Out of those pilot scripts, they order to production a certain amount of pilots to be shot. Out of those pilots to be shot, they winnow it down to a certain amount that they're going to order into episodes. Sometimes even, those episodes may be made and never aired. So by the time you get on the air, the odds of something actually staying on the air, first getting on the air is a lot of hoops you have to jump through, and then the odds of a show actually sticking with an audience is, you know, the odds are not really in that any show's favor. So I don't think that I'm unique in the fact that I've worked on things that that have been canceled. More things are canceled than are not.
Right. Well, we understand that, but we think your shows are terrific. And, in fact, I had never seen Wonderfalls before, but we ordered the DVD, and it's a terrific show.
Thank you.
Really enjoyed it. But one thing I noticed is, I know this is, I hope this doesn't sound the wrong way, but do you think your shows are for the weird and the intellectual?
Well, I don't know about the weird, certainly. I'm not so sure about the intellectual.
Okay.
I do think that, look, there are a lot, I mean, we can get into sort of the weeds about, you know, what makes a successful show. Really, the first thing that makes a successful show is launching it properly. And in order to launch something properly, you really need something that can be clearly marketed. And, you know, I've been really bright about doing shows about horses in space and talking souvenirs and things like that, which networks find it very difficult to sell, to really sell to an audience with promotion. So if you can't launch something, if you can't bring that initial audience to it, you're pretty much dead right out of the gate. So you really must have a successful launch, particularly nowadays when there are so many different outlets for material. You know, you need to snag in that big audience on the premiere, and then hopefully the fall off won't be too large, or at least snag in a respectable audience that you can grow, which is actually even harder to do. I think that I don't know that the writing on my shows or the stories that we tell on my shows are necessarily inaccessible to a large audience, but I think sometimes the premises might be.
Yeah, when people ask me to explain Firefly or Wonderfalls, it is sort of hard to give them the one- or two-sentence summary.
No, you really can't.
Well, the interesting thing, I mean, I guess that's sort of where it comes from, is, you know, yeah, most pilots get canceled, but they mostly suck, and you actually make stuff that people like, and it's actually kind of made you the king of the DVD releases.
Yeah.
I mean, do you go into the shooting now with the idea that, you know, this is going to be a DVD release, basically?
I did that on Wonderfalls. I absolutely did that on Wonderfalls. By the time we got on the air, the other thing, too, is the last couple, well, on Wonderfalls and a couple other shows that I've done, we've been mid-season shows. So we've actually had the luxury of producing our shows months before they ever aired. Often when you're doing a series, you are racing to make air dates. So you don't really have time to finish things off maybe the way you'd like to. So with Wonderfalls, we actually had most of those episodes in the can before anything actually even aired. But I could kind of see the writing on the wall with some of the meetings that I had at the network. You know, the politics at a network are such that the development people may love your thing, and then the current people who are in charge of the stuff that's on the air currently, hence the name current, or perhaps it means like raging current going over the rapids into sudden death, that sometimes those people's tastes might vary. So I could kind of feel that this thing wasn't going to get launched properly, and probably we would be on the air for 6 episodes. It was really 3. Maybe 4. I actually don't remember. But because of the advent of shows being released onto DVD, I felt that if we rounded off the first 13 episodes so that it felt as though there was some kind of resolve in such a way that in the best possible scenario we'd get picked up, obviously we would continue with the series and come up with more stories and complicate things. But that if it only went to 13... that if it was released on DVD, unlike Firefly, which really, I mean, I think the last image of Firefly is a guy floating in space going, well, here I am. I mean, it's a very, very oblique ending for that DVD set. But on Wonderfalls, I wanted people to feel like they'd had a complete experience. So, without being too, negative about it, I figured that, let's just plan for the worst and hope for the best. And so that is kind of what I'm doing these days.
How does the economics of that work out? I mean, can you make a series and have it work out okay if the DVD sells well?
Well, it's interesting. You know, people, I've seen people on the internet say, we're not going to buy those DVDs because we think that what Fox is doing, in the last 3 cases for me, it's been Fox. We think what Fox is doing is making these shows and getting them reviewed very well, and getting us all excited, and then canceling them so that they will force us to go out and buy their DVDs, which there is a certain kind of twisted network logic to that. However, the network doesn't actually own the DVDs. The studio does. A series is produced by a studio, and then it's sold to a network. So in perpetuity, really, the studio owns that material. The network's really licensing it. And in the case of when I'm working for 20th Television and selling to the Fox network, people often get confused because it is the same parent company, and they think it's the same company. It's really not. It's a studio and a network. So the network is actually taking a huge loss when they cancel something. They're taking a loss in one area, but they're hoping to make up for it by putting on, you know, The Swan or Dancing with Washed Up Has-Beens or whatever it is that they're putting on. But what they've done is they've sold advertising time for whatever series it is they're canceling, and they have to somehow square that with the people who have put in their advertising dollars, and they've made an agreement that this is the product we're going to air and this is what you're going to advertise on. So economically, the studio can end up recouping some of their investment that they put into the show, but it really doesn't affect the network's bottom line at all.
You have a lot of strong female characters in some of your shows, some real tough ladies. Some people tell me, I'm a psychologist, and some people tell me this kind of thing is encouraging girls and women to become more aggressive in real life. Do you think this is true? Particularly Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I mean, this is what people tell me.
Well, I mean, I don't know, actually. I think that... it's interesting, you know, I was born in the 60s, mm-hmm. and so I grew up with television, and certainly the things that I saw on television influenced me. I'm sure that it influences the culture. I'm not sure how much it reflects the culture. When you're writing a hero or a heroine, you are idealizing human behavior. So you're not necessarily writing people with all their warts, although the most interesting characters that, that we've done have been characters like Jay on Wonderfalls, where she's kind of snarky and drunk and lazy, but strong at the same time. So it's, maybe I'm encouraging young women to be snarky, lazy, drunk, and live in a trailer park.
Okay. Well, I guess that's better than violent, maybe. I don't know.
Well, it depends, you know. Sometimes violence can be a force of good.
That's right. I think that's true. And maybe there are some good things about, you know, these aggressive ladies. Is there a reason that you have all these female characters?
Well, that's interesting, actually. I don't know that there's a reason, except that they seem to be about 50% of the population.
Right.
I think that, you know, that's actually a really intelligent question for which I do not have a ready intelligent answer, except to say that I think we go to that place because it's maybe underserviced.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ground is a little bit more fertile. Although, I will say, by the time I got to Wonder, or to The Inside, which also had a young female protagonist, I was starting to feel like, you know, the 40-year-old guy who was writing 16 and 17-year-old girls, and it started to feel a little weird.
Well, how did you get into the business? You're not a film school graduate, are you?
No, I'm not a graduate of anything.
I think that's great. Could you tell us about that? I mean, you know, so many people talk to me, and they're always telling me, you know, my kid has to go to college, they have to go to graduate school, but you've been so successful without all that. How'd you do it?
Well, they told me in high school I'd have to take algebra if I wanted to go to college.
It's a math problem.
Pretty much, that's still that deal. And I'm actually not even being facetious. Well, the way I got into it was I was one of these kids that grew up in Southern California with a Super 8 camera.
Mm-hmm.
And my friends and myself, we made movies in our backyard since the time I was about 8 years old. And that's really all I did. And eventually I thought I was going to be Steven Spielberg and I'd be a big feature director. And when I graduated into sound, which was 16 mil, I mean, I can't even imagine what it would be like growing up today with Mac technology and iMovie and these digital cameras. I mean, I would just be in hog heaven. Because back then, you know, we were Super 8 film.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, magnetic sound stripe. And, you know, you had to cut picture 24 frames off so that you wouldn't lose the soundtrack. That's always what I wanted to do. When I graduated to sound, and so I started writing scripts so that actors could say things. Because for the first, I'd say, 10 years, when I was a kid, pretty much everything was fight scenes. We'd do a Logan's Run chase, and we'd do a $6 million man fight, and we'd do a Star Trek fight, and we'd do a Bionic Woman fight. And so everything was a chase, which actually was the best education to learn montage and how the language of film really works. And so I started writing so that I would have something to shoot. And it just turned out I had a facility for that. And then at some point, I was writing these very low-budget straight-to-video features, not even straight to DVD. This is back in the days of, you know, VHS tapes. And somebody suggested, I was trying to get an agent, and somebody suggested that I try television, which, of course, was completely beneath me. I could not do television. I'm too busy writing Cybercracker and, you know, these crappy low-budget movies. And what I did was I wrote a spec. I actually worked in syndicated television for a while based on some feature specs that I had. And then I wrote a spec X-Files, and I got on Lois and Clark, and then I actually got on the X-Files. And what I learned in television was the writers have all the power in TV. Like, television is heaven if you're a writer-producer.
Unlike film.
I mean, I do everything. When I run a show, I'm not only deciding creatively the direction of the series as a whole, but I'm casting the show, I'm hiring the wardrobe people, I'm vetting costumes, I'm giving notes to the composer, I'm sitting in the editing room, I'm directing when I get a chance. It's the best film school there is, production of television. Also, the beast gets made. I mean, I actually counted up the other day how many hours of produced television I've done, and it was like 170 hours. And a lot of feature writers who actually make real money writing movies might have 2, 4, 6 hours worth of material that actually gets produced. in the last 10 years, I've had 109 hours that I've actually written, shot, and aired. That's a lot.
It's almost like the kind of learning curve you got in film and under the old studio system where they were making a picture a week.
Very, very similar.
Well, I understand you're working on or actually you finished, I guess, a screenplay of Robert Heinlein's The Moon is a Harsh Mistress.
I did.
Tell us about that. People haven't had a lot of success translating Heinlein to a film.
Yeah, there's really only been, well, there's been two, I think. Puppet Masters, I know, was made. And, of course, Starship Troopers.
I meant artistic success, I guess.
Well, I guess it was made by people who clearly didn't read the book. I was actually sniffing around to see who owned the rights to Stranger in a Strange Land. And so I sent my agent off trying to figure that out. And that's actually been in turnaround, and I think they may even be making it now, but a lot of people had tried their hand at that. And what we discovered was that there was a producer who actually had a deal with the Heinlein Estate and had the rights to quite a few of his books. And this was one that they were looking for a writer for. And so I said, well, what if that was me? And so he set up a meeting, and I went in, and I basically pitched my take on the book. You know, here's what I think it should be, and here's how I think this should be adapted. And I will say, having written all this television, I think really helped me. And by the way, having rewritten a lot of television, mm-hmm. like scripts that don't work that have to shoot, I'm used to reading material and seeing sort of like cataloging what I need to do to make this work as a script as I go through something. So I went in and pitched my take on it, and I felt very protective of it. Like, the last thing I wanted to do was go in and have it turn into, Starship Troopers, or something that would really be offensive to Heinlein's legacy. So I tried to really protect that, and the producers were actually very accommodating in that respect. And I spent probably a year adapting this book. I mean, in between working on shows and that sort of thing, I did two or three different versions of the script, and everyone sort of liked it, and I wasn't quite happy with it. And finally, they were going to give me some scene notes, and I said, instead of giving me your scene notes, I have an idea. What if I throw this out and start over? Because I think I have a new idea. And I sat down and did it again, and I think kind of nailed it. So now it's being taken to directors. The producers are, you know, trying to set it up at studios. Everyone was actually very happy with the way that adaptation turned out. And actually, I have to say, I was happy with the way it turned out because there was a certain amount of ghosts that were haunting me while I was writing that because you have, of course, the Heinlein fans. It's like, well, what did I get myself into? I have these Heinlein fans. They're going to hate whatever I do. I've got, you know, the ghost of Robert Heinlein hanging over me. This can't suck. This has got to be good. So, of course, once you go into something with that attitude, it really blows. And you just kind of have to try to release that kind of pressure and just try to service the material as best you can. And that's what I did. It was a really hard book to adapt. I mean, you've read the book?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's sprawling and takes place over many years, and there's lots of characters and tons of political theory and really just lots of people sitting around talking. So I had to take that and try to translate it into narrative and emotion in a way that it really wasn't in the book, something for the screen. Let's hope it gets made, and then you'll be able to make a judgment.
Well, I can't wait, actually. I'd really like
great.
To see it.
I actually got to, at least in this draft, who knows if it actually gets made, how much will change. But I actually preserved things that even the producers didn't expect I would be able to preserve going in. Things like Heinlein's notion of the line marriage and that very complex familial system that they have on Luna, at least in that part of Luna. So I got to keep all that, and obviously the catapults in there, and you know, a lot of Prof's libertarian philosophy is still in there, and so I think it's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's very cool.
That is. You've gotten a lot of internet support for your shows and for Serenity. In fact, Glenn and I went to a pre-release screening for that for bloggers. How has that helped you?
Well, I'm sure that actually Glenn knows a little bit what it's like to put your name into Google. you know, actually, when I started writing on anything that anyone actually saw, which I guess would be the last season of Lois and Clark, there was already sort of an internet fan base that was responding live as those episodes aired. So I've pretty much had that ever since I've been working professionally in television. It hurts. It hurts and it helps. I actually love it because for the most part, people really seem to like what I do. But I also know that writers get trashed on these boards.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I was told when yeah, of course, that's what I mean. Yeah, you know, it's like when I started at Angel, you know, the Buffy writers were saying, you know, just don't go there. No good can come from it. I mean, we all did. I mean, you know, Joss frequents those boards, and I would frequent those boards, and Marty would frequent those boards, and David Fury would frequent those boards, and you know, how can you not look? I mean, if somebody is commenting on what you're doing for a living, like the thing that's most important to you career-wise, and people are actually gathering to discuss it, you're going to listen in. I defy people not to. And it actually hurt me a little bit on Angel the first couple of years because I would listen to this very vocal minority of people who maybe just, you know, didn't like one thing or another, and I started to get into the weeds with the fans.
Mm-hmm.
And start to care about the stuff that the fans cared about.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking about the minutia. And, you know, you think there are factions in Iraq? Forget about it. Factions in fandom are far more violent, and they believe things far more strongly than Sunnis or Shiites or anybody. And so you really have to try not to let that influence you, because really the only thing that should be influencing you is the work itself. Like, what do you need for a story? What do you need for the narrative, and what does the show need, and what's right for the characters? Not, you know, if I do this thing with this character, then people will think I'm really cool.
So if you quit reading some of those your fan mail and that sort of thing?
Well, not so much fan mail, but, you know, there are these discussion
chat
sites.
Right,
the chat sites, yeah.
Yeah, or I'd go to Usenet, and I would, you know, look at, like, the Angel discussions, and I'd look at the, you know, the Firefly discussions and that sort of thing. So now mostly what I try to do is just go look for praise.
There you go.
Good idea.
Yeah.
Well, now you've just gotten a new pilot accepted for a show called Drive.
Yes, right? We just started prepping that, actually.
And what's that about, and when is it going to air?
Well, what is it about? It is about an illegal cross-country road race that starts in the southernmost point of the United States, and the participants don't actually know where they're going. And I didn't sell it like this, but to me this is what this really is. It's North by Northwest and Magnolia on wheels. It's all these different characters from all different walks of life who are involved in this race, and they each have huge, emotional, Doug Serkian reasons that they must win, and only one person can. So it's a way for me, and I've created it with another writer named Ben Queen, who actually came to me with this idea, and together we wrote the pilot and developed it into a show. And going back to what I was saying before about possibly sometimes the premise of a show might not be something that an audience can immediately get their head around, this was a way to do the kind of absurd humor and romance and comedy that we did on Wonderfalls, the kind of suspense and action and big heroic emotions that we did on Firefly, the kind of men and women Douglas Sirk melodrama that we did on Angel, and the kind of terror and suspense that I did on The Inside. It's a way to do all the things that I love to do on the broadest possible canvas. This show can do anything. It can bear the weight of anything. I mean, I've often said that I think what makes a good series, or at least a hit series, although if I knew exactly what made a hit series, I probably wouldn't be canceled more than a bad set. But what I think you need is a premise that is very specific, yet very broad at the same time. So if you're talking about a procedural, you think of something like CSI. That is very specific. These are the forensics guys. They solve crimes with science. That is a very specific idea. It's not just cop show. But it's so broad that you can tell any kind of crime story within that franchise. If you think about Lost, you understand it. People in a plane crashed. They need to get off this island. That could be Gilligan's Island, or it could be Lost. It could be big, or it could be silly. And with something like Drive, it could be Cannonball Run, or it could be The Game with Michael Douglas. I mean, it can be anything. It can be about a father and a daughter who are trying to reconcile their alienation to one another on the road. It could be a man who believes that the people running this race have abducted his wife, and he will only get her back if he wins this race. It can be about two brothers. It can be about a woman whose parents were in this race 20 years ago, and they died, and now she's trying to infiltrate this race. It can be about anything. That's what I'm doing.
Cool. We can't wait to see it.
Sounds great. Is that on Fox?
Yeah.
Okay. Great.
We're almost out of time, but before we end, anything special you want to say to your fans out there?
Oh, thanks. Thanks for making me stinking rich.
How about sincere?
No, I would like to say that, you know, I actually interact with, I sort of don't like the word fans in a way, although I kind of do because I grew up as a fan. I went to science fiction conventions and, you know, I did the kinds of fan activities and lived in the world of fandom that the people who seem to enjoy the stuff that I do do as well. So I'm just, you know, I'm already at their party, and not unlike them, I didn't bring a date.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for
no
your
problem.
Time.
Well, that was fun. I mean, I know I'm more into science fiction than you are, but you sounded like you had a good time, too.
Yeah, you know, I'm not into science fiction that much, but these guys make it interesting for everybody.
They really do. And, you know, it's funny. It turns out we mentioned when the tape wasn't rolling to Tim Minear that we had John Scalzi and Old Man's War on here, and he seemed very interested in the whole Scalzi universe, the Scalziverse. Maybe there'll be a movie in that someday.
That'd be great. I'd see that.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back whenever we feel like it. You can check for updates at our websites at instapundit.com and drhelen.blogspot.com, or you can subscribe via iTunes, which we like, as well as podcasts at Yahoo, Podcast Alley, and, well, anywhere else you want to subscribe. We'll talk to you sometime soon.
Talk to you next time.